Hello and welcome to Science World. Carol Pearson tells us that scientists who rushed to develop anti-Ebola vaccines during the deadly West Africa outbreak are starting to see positive results from their research. Philip Alexio reports that scientists may have solved the mystery of why the surface of Mercury is so dark and non-reflective. And we'll talk with a Caltech scientist who, with a colleague, has found evidence that suggests that our solar system may have once housed a number of super-Earth-type planets long before the current inner planets formed. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Ebola has claimed the lives of more than 10,000 people in West Africa. Since the middle of last year, researchers have rushed to get anti-Ebola vaccines into clinical trials. While it's too early to say that any of the potential vaccines work, some scientists say that they are seeing strong results from some of their studies. Carol Pearson reports.
It's ironic. Just as the Ebola epidemic in West Africa seems to be waning, clinical trials of potential vaccines are underway. A vaccine candidate is being tested in Guinea, where the virus is still active. This vaccine has already been tested on volunteers in the U.S., Europe, and other African countries. The Liberian government and the U.S. National Institutes of Health conducted a successful clinical trial of a different vaccine candidate, but because the number of new cases in Liberia is so low, researchers want to continue the trial in Guinea or Sierra Leone. At Emory University in Atlanta, an investigational vaccine was given to an American doctor after he was possibly exposed to Ebola in Sierra Leone. Dr. Mark Mulligan reported the effects of the vaccine in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
We saw strong responses from the innate immune system, the immediate responses, the first defenders in our body, and also from the subsequent antibodies and T cells that we want a vaccine to produce.
The patient did not develop the Ebola virus. He may not have been infected, but the immune response was what doctors hoped to see. Dr. Thomas Geisbert at the University of Texas Medical Branch was one of the researchers who developed this potential vaccine. He says there's still a lot of work to do.
A lot of these different vaccines and treatments were developed against one species of Ebola and a particular strain of that species. So there are five different species of Ebola virus. Three of those cause disease and morbidity and mortality in man.
Dr. Geisbert says a vaccine that might work against the Zaire Ebola virus, the species circulating in West Africa, might not work against another type of deadly Ebola virus. Dr. Jesse Goodman is a specialist in disease preparedness. He says if the vaccines work, they still could be used in West Africa.
It could benefit people if this outbreak went the wrong way again, and even more importantly, these could be incredibly important tools for, you know, future outbreaks.
The results of the vaccine trial in Guinea could be available in July. The results of the trial conducted by the National Institutes of Health might be ready by early next year. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Solar energy production continues to grow in the United States, but as more and more homeowners adopt solar energy, some are complaining that the trend unfairly shifts the cost of maintaining the nation's electrical grid to non-solar customers. Jeff Swicord reports.
Like most Americans, the appliances in Anya Schulman's kitchen run on electricity, except for a gas stove.
Although the oven's electric, dishwasher's electric.
In 2008, more than 50 neighbors in her Mount Pleasant community of Washington, D.C. came together to form a solar co-op. By coming together, they were able to install solar at a cheaper price. Schulman says the benefits sell themselves.
The idea that you can save money and also create local jobs and do it in a way that's clean for the environment is pretty much appealing across the board, no matter what your politics are, what your background or culture.
The United States is rapidly becoming a leader in solar technology. According to government statistics, last year was the biggest year ever for solar power in U.S. history. However, solar energy still provides less than 1% of the nation's electricity, with traditional sources, coal burning and nuclear, providing the rest. This overwhelming dominance has created friction. Schulman sells the excess power from her solar panels back to the local utility, which is called net metering. But some utility companies have levied special charges against solar customers for net metering. She says it's a ploy to discourage solar.
There's a place in Alabama, for example, that if you put solar on your roof, instead of your bill going down by the amount of energy you produce, your bill actually goes up because the utility has put such a high surcharge, it's like a special solar charge, that you actually lose money if you go solar.
Some experts say the extra charges are necessary to keep infrastructure costs evenly spread among solar and non-solar customers. Energy economist David Kreutzer is with the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
It's great for the people, perhaps, with the rooftop solar systems. But the other consumers of electricity have to pay for that price difference. They have to pay for the cost of the grid, of the generating capacity that has to be there for those peak times.
A number of states, including California, are trying to resolve this disagreement as more Americans turn to renewable sources of energy. Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Washington.
A team of scientists said that new research may have solved the long-standing mystery of why the surface of planet Mercury has such a dark and dull finish. Science World's Philip Alexiou tells us more.
At first glance, the planet Mercury looks a lot like our moon, both gray and pockmarked with craters, after being bombarded with meteorites and blasted by the solar wind over the millennia. The color of Mercury's surface, though, is much darker than the moon, so much so that scientists consider it to be the least reflective of all the planets in our solar system. Its nearest neighboring planet, Venus, on the other hand, is considered the brightest and most reflective of our planetary neighbors. Writing in the latest edition of the journal Nature Geoscience, a team of scientists said their study suggests that a steady dusting of carbon released by passing comets over billions of years has slowly painted Mercury's surface black. Since comets often break apart as they get close to the sun, nearby Mercury has been receiving a steady barrage of cometary dust from these crumbling celestial bodies. Carbon makes up about 25% by weight of that comet dust. Calculations made from our computer model suggested that Mercury's surface should be between 3-6% carbon after billions of years collecting cometary dust. Experiments conducted by the researchers verified that all the carbon Mercury's collected over the years would also create the same kind of dark and dull surface it has today. The researchers concluded that the carbon from cometary dust has been like a stealth darkening agent, covering Mercury's surface like an invisible paint. For Science World, I'm Philip Alexiou.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk with a scientist from Caltech whose research suggests that our solar system may have once housed a number of giant planets long before Earth and the other current inner planets were formed. So, for this week's Science World Quick Quiz, we have a brain teaser about the formation of the solar system. After conducting research with radioactive dating techniques, scientists now believe that our solar system is approximately how old? Is it A, 10.3 billion years, B, 1.5 billion years, or C, 4.6 billion years? Think about it. We'll have the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
California's drought continues, and the state's governor has had to take some serious steps to conserve its water. Science World's Ann Ball has more.
California has imposed mandatory water restrictions for the first time in its history as the western U.S. state continues to suffer under a crippling four-year drought.
We're in an historic drought, and that demands unprecedented action. For that reason, I'm issuing an executive order mandating substantial water reduction across our state.
Governor Jerry Brown issued an executive order Wednesday for all residents and businesses across the state to cut their water usage by 25%. The governor's order includes replacing nearly 5 million square meters of lawns with drought-tolerant landscaping and provides financial help for people to replace their old appliances with more water and energy-efficient models. Mr. Brown made the announcement from a remote area of the Sierra Nevada mountain region, which he said would normally be covered with nearly 2 meters of snow. California receives much of its water from the winter snowfall in the Sierra Nevada mountains, but the current drought has led to the lowest snow levels ever recorded. For Science World, I'm Ann Ball.
Prior to any surgical procedure, doctors try to learn as much as possible about the state of the organs they plan to operate on. A new camera developed in the Netherlands can now make that easier by giving surgeons an incredibly detailed look inside blood vessels all the way to the patient's heart. George Putich has more.
Blockages in coronary arteries caused by the buildup of plaque are the main cause of heart attacks. In most cases, doctors treat the problem by widening the artery with a mechanical device called a stent, inserted at the end of a long, thin, wire-like catheter. But within a year, about 10% of patients have to return for another procedure, says cardiologist Evelyn Rager.
Roughly half of the patients have to come back because we did not an excellent job in the blockage that is causing the heart attack, and the other half of the patient has to come back because we overlook additional lesions, additional problems that are present in the artery.
This situation could improve considerably with a new camera that provides a clearer, more detailed view from inside arteries, developed at the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, Netherlands. Currently, to take different images through the catheter, surgeons control the rotation of the catheter's camera from outside the body. The new camera has its own tiny electrical motor. Professor Ton van der Steen is the head of Department of Biomedical Engineering at the Erasmus Medical Center.
With this system, you have the rotation exactly where it needs to be, only in the tip. So you have a micromotor in the tip that can rotate, and that's why it can rotate so fast and so accurately.
Researchers are still experimenting on lab animals, but the results are stunning. While catheter cameras now in use take only about 100 images per second, too slow not to be distorted by the movement of the heart, the new camera can take 2,500 images in between two heartbeats. Its 1 millimeter thick motor rotates a mirror 5,600 times per second, while a fast pulsing laser lights up the environment, allowing the camera to take sharp pictures of the artery wall.
Suddenly, we get a view on the blood vessel like we just know from the textbook. And we can see that in our living patients at the very moment when we have to do the operation.
Scientists say they are now trying to build an even smaller motor, only half a millimeter thick. The new catheter camera was presented at the Optics of Cardiology Symposium in Rotterdam on March 11th, but researchers say it will take up to 3 years before they start with trials on humans. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Tuesday, April 7th is World Health Day, and the World Health Organization is urging governments to enact robust food safety systems to protect people from contaminated foods that can kill them. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
People have to eat to live. But the World Health Organization warns that what you eat can kill you. Thanks to globalization, a vast variety of foods in and out of season now are available to people around the world. Unfortunately, the WHO says food can become contaminated with harmful bacteria, viruses, parasites, or chemicals anywhere along the complicated production and distribution food chain that has developed with globalization. The UN agency says these contaminants cause more than 200 diseases, ranging from diarrhea to cancers. For the first time, it is issuing estimates of the global burden of foodborne diseases. Department of Food Safety and Zoonosis Director Kazuaku Miyagishima tells VOA, there are so many food hazards, WHO experts had to limit their research to different enteric diseases.
We picked up 22 bacteria, virus, and parasites. And according to our estimates, in 2010, the 22 different pathogens caused 582 million cases of foodborne illnesses, leading to 351,000 deaths all over the world.
Dr. Miyagishima notes the organization hopes to publish information later in the year regarding food contamination from chemicals. He says Africa is the region with the highest burden for enteric foodborne diseases, followed by Southeast Asia. He says the situation is particularly bad in Africa because the continent does not have well-developed food safety and health systems. He says the production and preparation of foods tend to be below hygienic safety standards. He says very young children globally are the major victims of unsafe food.
40% of illness and deaths happen in the children of 5 years or under. And in the global population, this child population account 5 years and under accounts for 9%. So 9% of the population account for 40% of foodborne disease.
The World Health Organization is urging governments to enact food safety laws and systems to protect their people. It also recommends they refer to international food standard guidelines set by the WHO and Food and Agriculture Organization. It says there are several simple measures consumers can take to protect themselves. It advises them to read labels when buying food, to wash hands and wash foods, to not mix raw and cooked foods together, and to thoroughly cook food. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
So, do you think you have the correct answer for this week's Science World Quick Quiz? Well, let's find out. After conducting research with radioactive dating techniques, scientists have determined that our solar system is approximately how old? Is it A, 10.3 billion years, B, 1.5 billion years, or C, 4.6 billion years? The answer is C. Scientists believe that meteorites cooled and condensed into solids from the same cloud, a primordial gas that also formed the sun and the planets. So, using some radioactive dating techniques on meteorite samples, they determined that our solar system is about 4.6 billion years old. It would take a few million years. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
According to a new study by scientists in California, billions of years ago, as the solar system was starting to take shape, the inner solar system may have been first occupied by a number of super-Earths, which were larger than Earth but smaller than Neptune. Konstantin Batygin from the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, along with his colleague Gregory Lachlan from the University of California at Santa Cruz, believe that these super-Earths may have been annihilated by Jupiter as it wandered toward and back from the sun. By eliminating these inner solar system super-Earths, Jupiter may have actually paved the way for the creation of Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Dr. Batygin joins us today to talk about what he and his colleague learned from their research, and he gives us some insight into how our solar system was formed.
A super-Earth is a type of planet, one that we do not have in our solar system now. It is an object which is typically a few times bigger in mass than the Earth itself, maybe a couple times bigger in physical size. However, it is an object that is typically smaller than the giant planets that we have in our solar system, such as Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune.
When we think of the different planets of the solar system, we either think of the gas giants that are further out into the solar system or the rockier planets such as Earth. What were these super-Earths? Were they rocky planets? Were they gas giants?
There's something in between, as a matter of fact. We have found a huge number of super-Earths orbiting other stars. In fact, they appear to be the most dominant type of planet in the galaxy. Well, they fall in a rather diverse range. So they tend to be, as far as we can tell, something in between the gas giants and the rocky planets of the solar system. They tend to have some large component of the mass in rock, so they have rocky cores, but also they tend to be enveloped in rather extensive atmospheres, primarily made up of hydrogen and helium. So they're really a different type of object. We do not have something of the sort in our solar system, which is quite strange because we think that these are the most dominant forms of planets that occur in the galaxy.
Did recent research and findings regarding exoplanets and star systems play any role in developing your findings?
Absolutely. Before the search for exoplanets began, before it really was kicked into high gear and we found all of the extrasolar planets, planets around other stars, that is, we believed as a community that we understood the formation of our own solar system. We now know that this is not the case. The theoretical model that was put forth before was basically fine-tuned to reproduce the structure of our solar system. We now know that that's not the common outcome of the planet formation process. Therefore, we have to sort of go back to the drawing board in some sense. We have to rethink how the solar system has formed. And in fact, this project that my colleague Greg Laughlin and I undertook is initiated by this finding of extrasolar planets, by realizing that the solar system is strange, right? Something went horribly wrong in our solar system, which set it down on a path which ultimately made it different from the common planetary system orbiting a sun-like star.
I know in the research it's mentioned that there were a number of these super-Earth planets in existence. How many do you think the solar system housed?
The number itself is a rather ambiguous one. This is something that we can only inform ourselves about by looking at other stars. So other sun-like stars have anywhere between 1 and 8 such super-Earths. So we can only sort of imagine that the solar system once had some number which is comparable to what other sun-like stars have. One quantity which we can, however, make a reasonable statement about is the amount of mass contained in that primordial population of planets. To this end, we believe that there was something on the order of 10 Earth masses contained in these close-in initial planets that orbited our sun.
I understand that Jupiter may have played a role in their demise in the shaping of our solar system as it is now. Is that true?
That's absolutely correct. So Jupiter actually, as we now understand, did quite a bit of wandering around through the primordial solar system. See, and when the solar system formed, when planets form around stars, they do not form just in empty space. The early stages of star formation are also usually accompanied by these rather vast disks made up of hydrogen and helium primarily that circle around the stars, right? So planets are born in an environment which is very gas-rich. Jupiter, which was born in this in the same environment, interacted with the primordial gas that was around the sun during its first few million years of lifetime. And due to these interactions, we believe it first moved in. So its orbit first shrunk, became smaller, and subsequently grew back out. Now, this inward and outward migration, we believe, sparked a rather violent episode of collisional grinding in the solar system. That is, as Jupiter's orbit shrunk, it captured planetesimals, in other words, planetary building blocks, and excited their orbits to the point where these rocks began colliding and grinding down to smaller sizes. Then, subsequently to this process, this population of newly generated sort of small rocks, also due to interactions with the gas, spiraled onto the sun and gravitationally pushed the pre-existing planets onto the surface of the sun. So it was an indirect attack initiated by Jupiter, so to speak. During Jupiter's inward migration, it caused its collisional cascade of rocks to spiral down and gravitationally shepherd pre-existing planets onto the surface of the sun.
That was Konstantin Batygin from the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, in Pasadena, California. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.